Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Richard Hansen. He heads up a company called Soluz, which is based in Honduras in Central America. It has the mission of advancing the global transition to sustainable energy. It has a special commitment to increasing access to electricity using solar technology. Happy to have Richard on the podcast today. Richard, how are you today? Good to see you.
Doing fine. Yeah, it's good to see you. And thanks for inviting me in.
Really nice to have you on the podcast. And I know you're a lot of the time you're in Honduras or different parts of the world, but today you are where?
I'm in the greater Boston area in my home office here.
And that's where you grew up in the greater Boston area.
Well, actually, I'm a boy from Connecticut. So I was brought up in Connecticut, but I went to school, the university, and first in Worcester Polytech, WPI, study engineering in Worcester, Mass. And then I ended up based in the Boston area after graduation. Yeah. And so I've been in Massachusetts since then, which brings me back to like 1976. I graduated from engineering and I studied at Boston University, a master's in business. So I've grown attached to Massachusetts and been here since then. Good. I live internationally as well. There's more to that. Yeah,
there sure is. That we're going to get to this intriguing story, but I think I was doing a little poking around, and after you got your college experiences, you went to Westinghouse, and you know, talk about the flip side of what you're doing now with small distributed generation solar systems. You know, there you were sort of in the supply side of what large fossil plants and nuclear reactors and things like that.
Right. You know, when I graduated from WPI just before graduation, I interviewed and joined with Westinghouse. Actually, my maternal grandfather had a company building machine tools in Connecticut. I could have joined the family company, but I decided to branch out and got into the energy industry by working for Westinghouse. So I started to learn about that in what was, as an engineer, building equipment for large power plants, up to 1,000 megawatts, coal-fired nuclear power plants. And I was there for about 6 years, first as an engineer, and then I was a manager of manufacturing and industrial engineering there. So I had a chance to learn the management side of that and what was involved with building conventional power plants. And I, during there, they were paying for my master's degree at Boston University. I studied at night, kind of took that track, but then took some classes on entrepreneurship. And I guess with the family origins, I kind of decided to go off and pursue some other interests.
I was curious about this because in your timeline, 1984, somewhere in your documentation, you say you discovered your passion. And how did you find photovoltaics? How did that come about?
Yeah. Well, what happened to me is while on vacation from Westinghouse, I traveled with another engineer. I traveled to the Dominican Republic first in December 1981, which went into January 82. And then we returned again, 1983, basically getting a winter break in the Caribbean. Nice. While there, I started to learn a bit more about the Dominican Republic and found that 50% of the population had no electricity. So here, this boy from Connecticut that was brought up with a light switch next to my bed. I went, wow, right? You know, and all these people. So and the other thing that happened to me. You know, I guess while I was at Westinghouse, we saw this this movie. What you are is where you were when you were 10. So it was about working across generations. In any event, so, at a young age in fifth grade, we had a Spanish teacher that came in to our class. So that kind of planted the seed with the language. And we were learning also at that time about electricity. So, you know, those were things that were planted into a 10-year-old, and you know, they were interests. So I really wanted to learn Spanish, and so I started to pursue how could I get involved in international development, and looked into different options for that. One thing I did is I contacted USP Corps, but I was interested specifically in, I started getting interested in the Dominican Republic and renewable energy. I started at the time issues with energy. I started to look into renewable energy. I had looked first into wind power since I graduated as a mechanical engineer.
Yeah.
You know, wind machines are nice mechanical machines. So that's how I started to combine my interest in renewable energy and Latin America. And at one point, having traveled a couple times with a friend that I stayed at another, went back again in March of 83 for a month. And then I kind of started to plan on this longer trip, like to stay there for like 5 or 6 months to get immersed and learn the language. I told my friend that's what I'd like to do. I had money saved up in the bank and all, so I could do that. So I left Westinghouse. And it turned out that in my explorations of like small wind machines, like Mike Berge had recently started making these, you know, 1 kilowatt machines. I was looking at what was available for wind. I went to a place called on Martha's Vineyard called the Wind Farm Museum. They had wind machines. They kind of had shown some technology, and I learned about photovoltaics there. Their son gave a class on PV at their facility there on the island. So I learned about PV, and I actually said, "Wow, this is interesting." And I bought a PV module in November 1983, an Arco 16-2000, model 16-2000, 35 watts. And the industry was about 20.8 megawatts when I bought that. Very small. I look back at it now and say, wow, that was really an early stage, but I could figure out, kind of what you could do with that. So put things together and figured out how to power lights, radio, TV, and returned in January 21st, 1984, launched into the PV business by carrying that module under my arm and by getting set up. And by April of 1984, I installed it in the home of my first customer, Felipe Martinez, and his wife, Alta Gracia. That kind of got me started in the solar business in there. And I financed that system for them over a 4-year payment plan. So I started to trust rural farm families to make payments. I had also looked into what microcredit was. So that was basically my start in the business with, walking into the dark, not knowing how it was going to turn out. But
it's very brave. Very brave, but insightful. And then in 1989, you got funded by the US DOE to go to Honduras.
Yeah, I mean, a lot happened in the Dominican Republic with creating a model. The United States Department of Energy funded a case study in 1987 when we had 100 customers. And, people came to visit from the Oak Ridge Lab first and then Sandia Lab. And so what happened was the DOE started to pick up what we were doing. Bud Annan was great. Bud Annan ran the solar program, and he was out there. I mean, he was where USAID was really not internationally kind of looking at how to get the technology out where there were markets. So we did a visit to Honduras with a person from Oak Ridge Lab to see about replication, because we had moved along pretty well in the Dominican Republic with the concept of microfinance combined with local installers. So, was it possible to replicate? So the U.S. Department of Energy funded that trip. That's how I entered, officially into Honduras in 89. And then we shifted over to Sandia Labs, and we brought folks from Sandia over to the Dominican Republic. They actually had, we had a meeting in my house. I have an eco lodge over in the Dominican Republic, and a house I built in 1989, still have it. I'll be there next month. But anyways, we met there and then planned out what we're going to do. And Sandia provided 3 years of funding. And the funding went to a nonprofit organization, because in 1984, in September 27th, 1984, when I returned from 5 or 6 months in the Dominican Republic and had a system in, I set up a nonprofit in Massachusetts called Enersol. And that goal was to introduce solar technology in Latin America. So that that funding entered into the nonprofit organization to provide training and technical assistance to introduce technology. So we basically replicated the program in Honduras, and we had a linkage with U.S. Peace Corps. We did that in the DR, had volunteers that were in rural areas that helped to introduce and bring in local counterparts. We did that in Honduras. So So that's how I kind of got into Honduras in 1989. By 94, I decided to, I had a small business in the Dominican Republic. Part of the model was to show how you do a small business. Then we got other people into the business by showing in during workshops. We actually had participants, whether they were Peace Corps volunteers or their counterparts, install systems that were actual customers of the business. So they could see this really worked. Customers were paying, you know, they'd bring out the money and pay for their system, and the course participants were working it. So we did that. So I had a business in the Dominican Republic. I decided to set up a business in Honduras, and there were things lining up in the sector, kind of impact investors looking, you know, kind of hungry to see where they could put investments into this. And so in 1994, actually arranged for a $100,000 grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, and I set up Solus Inc. It's my company in Massachusetts, Solus Inc. Founded that in June of 1993. And that helped me raise some socially responsible investment funds, the type of impact funds that allowed us to kind of move forward. So we established Solus Inc. and Solus Inc. set up an operation starting in January of 94 in Honduras. And you know, the $100,000 from Rockefeller was to help us launch a leasing operation in Dominican Republic, but that also built a base so we could start in Honduras and got some other funding, some from Winrock International to set up the operation in Honduras. And that's the company that 30 years later continues today. I'll be in Honduras again. I keep going back and forth. I have a team there. And so
there's another aspect of this story. I believe that at that point you met your wife as well, who is from Honduras.
Yeah. Well, I should mention that in the process of getting set up in the Dominican Republic, where I ended up living, I married the mother of my two children in that would have been March of 1987. So a few years into that, I married, and my daughter was born 9 months later. My daughter is now 36. She was born in December 1987. And I have a son. They're both living here now. My son, my daughter, Mayrobi, my son, Richard. Richard was born in November 1989. So I have two children born to their Dominican mother and myself. We were together for about 20 years, and then we've gone our own ways.
And but certainly, it sounds like it certainly shaped your life. I mean, it linked you to that region.
Yes. I mean, I became very, you know, involved in the Dominican Republic. You know, I speak Spanish. My daughter says that that I'm at least 50% culturally Latino. I'm not. My DNA is zero on that side, but culturally very immersed and bilingual, and you know, eat the food, dance to the music, and so I'm very involved. And so I was involved in Honduras, and then as my first wife, the mother of my children, moved in different directions, I found a new person in my life in 2010. And we were married in 2016. So my wife is Honduran. It's my second wife. And so I have the company in Honduras, and we've got a house there and a villa in a gated community. And we keep working in the areas when it comes to the business, the 30% of rural populations. When I went to Honduras, it was similar to the Dominican Republic in 1989. Half of the Hondurans had no electricity. Now it's down to, well, kind of
still
the last
30%. 15%.
Well, it's 15%. Now it's 85% electrified. It was 50% electrified. But that 15% are really in rural areas. So 30% of people in the rural areas that are growing coffee and other agricultural things, 30% are still with kerosene lamps and candles and, you know, carrying cell phones to places where they can get things charged. So it's still, you know.
And Richard, I think part of your analysis when you go into a different country is to figure out, this came up in our call the other day, but part of your analysis involves, you know, what are people paying currently? Like, you know, for kerosene and for candles and what diesel fuel or whatever. that sort of provides you with an insight as to if you could shift them to solar, what would their financial appetite be for that, or capability be for that?
Yeah, that was really very important from the very beginning in the Dominican Republic. As a matter of fact, my first like little newsletter that somebody at the Department of Energy got their hands on it, that's what intrigued them, because I actually sat down and took the Rayovac dry cell batteries, extracted energy, and I used a multi-tester to determine how much energy I was taking out of it. And I knew what the cost was at the local store. And I figured out that it was $50 a kilowatt hour at that time in 1984. And so that contributed was we had this evaluation of what people were spending already and, used a business approach to, turn an investment into a payment plan and then compare that. Well, what are you spending now? Because they were buying the kerosene, but then they bought the kerosene and I looked at how much lighting they're getting and what that cost and looked at, the dry cells, but also people were, and they were doing this all over the world, carrying car batteries from rural areas into towns to charge the car battery and run a television set. And Toshiba and other companies put a 12-volt connection in the back of the TV set. So they'd have the 120-volt connection, but you'd also have the 12-volt connection. So because people all over the world were running TVs off of car batteries. So what we basically ended up doing in a lot of cases is, charge the car battery with the PV modules, put, a little control arrangement in there. And so it was a transition that worked quite well. It just, turned out that way. And this began to kind of roll around, find that this was really quite a market. And so the U.S. Department of Energy was very interested. So we continued to do that, figure out, well, what can people afford? We take a business approach and provide a whole range of products, everything from, at this point, there's really high quality solar lanterns and small solar kits. And then we build larger kits, like the small kits can start at like 15 watts or 50 watts, but then we can build larger ones, 100 watts, 200 watts, a kilowatt, depending on what people need.
Let's start with it, Richard. Let me interrupt you because I'm fascinated by this. Let's start with the smallest kits, the most basic, the most impoverished, the most rural, whatever.
Yeah.
And I know that you use a product called Sun King, the solar suit, I think it's like a solar suitcase. And how much do they cost and what do they provide? It's just like.
Yeah. So there's the cost side of this. What does it cost on the loading dock in China, which is a U.S. company? But by the time you deliver to a remote household and, put the wiring in the house and all, we're currently using a 12. The next version is 15, but we actually have a 12-watt unit we've been putting in. Hmm. And they're very efficient now because the LEDs have gotten so efficient. This is what, all this stuff has advanced so much.
Right.
So now these new kits with, you've got very efficient LEDs providing like each lamp, maybe 200 lumens. And you've got now the lithium batteries that are inside. And so you got this package with a 12-watt module. We can get that delivered out to a remote area, for like $200. It's three lights and powers the cell phone, so they can charge the cell phone to get communications and charge a radio with it. So that's kind of the basic lights, radio, cell phone. When I started in the business, there were no cell phones in rural areas. So we were there before the cell phones. Now cell phones are an important item. But the next step you go up is, say, a 50-watt system. We've had some from this company, 60 watts, but now that version is now 50 watts. They keep kind of upgrading and modifying, which that then powers the 32-inch color TV. So that's exciting. You can actually have movies on a USB, or if you have the dish, you can watch various programming, watch your soccer games and other items, so other programming. So, that's kind of the next level if you want to get to, the TV. When we put in, so those are prepackaged kits from, we're using the company Sun King.
Yeah.
Integrated into the system is the PAYGO mechanism. So with our financing, it's a big help because the system shuts down after a month. We work with monthly payments. So they make a payment. It'll shut off if they don't make another payment. Once they make the payment, they get a code to reactivate it for a month, but they're usually not shutting down. But in any event, it's got that it's a pay as you go kind of a metering mechanism. Now, we've been financing ever since the Felipe Martinez in 1984, so we didn't have the mechanism. We used basically microfinance techniques, you know, to evaluate a customer and then make, you know, collections. And we continue to do that on our larger systems that don't have the pay-go mechanism. On the larger systems, we include fans in there, you know, with the TVs and other items. But then we get into freezers, you know, solar-powered freezers are very common. We do hundreds of freezers in very remote areas for rural stores, which is very popular. Many women own rural stores. Yeah. And so we go up for, you know, there's a whole range. So we don't go in and say, all right, everybody gets this. We you know, you get what you can afford. We do provide financing. And we use a crowdfunding platform for that. It's very interesting. Kiva, KIVA.org. You look at that, and you're going to see you can finance people all over the world. It's really it's a nonprofit, but they've loaned over $2 billion. So it's not like tiny.
Fantastic.
And they're in many countries. We're a partner. Solus Honduras is a partner of Kiva. You can search for us in there.
So then Kiva's funders are subsidizing the price of these kits or the price of this monthly service.
Well, let me explain. They're giving loans, so it's not like a a subsidy grant. So what happens? But it is subsidized because the interest rate is low. So what happens is anybody, even you, could go on the site and decide you want to make a loan as small as $25. So people all over the world, and I find it very exciting because there's a big demand for our products. I mean, to finance our products because people are excited about providing solar, you know, the issue of climate change and energy access. And so we put a customer up on the platform. We have a credit manager. Our installers install the system, take photos. We put a photo and information of the client. And then people around the world finance it. I mean, for our small kits, they're often financed within a couple of hours. And, you know, we have up to a month to finance them. It's very exciting. And I can show our employees, you know, people from Germany and, you know, Australia, all over the world, you know, put in their $25 or $50, whatever they want to do, and finance our customers. So it's a great thing. Now, for the lender, they're not donating the money. They get it back. Right. But they get zero interest. So we're actually getting money at zero interest. We do pay a fee, however. We pay a closing fee for those loans. So there is a revenue stream for Kiva from our closing fee. The lender is not getting interest, but they're getting their money back to keep making an impact by loaning it and loaning again and again. So I really like Kiva. It's a great program. I mean, anybody that wants to, let's say, be able to lend and have it done with, basically Kiva has partners like us. So you got to figure out, you know, what the partners are, but we've been doing that. We've loaned, I don't know the latest number, but I know it's over $1.2 million with Kiva funds to our customers.
Right. So that's fantastic. And then just to close the cycle on the smallest kit, the most basic Sun King kit, 12 watts, I think it was, about a $200 cost delivered. What would the monthly payment be? I know it probably varies, but what's approximately the monthly payment then?
Yeah, so we're gonna, it depends on the length of the loan, but you know, it's $10 a month. Roughly $10 a month. We do like anywhere between $10 and $12 a month. We do about an 18-month maximum loan length. They do it in 12 months, but they can do 18 and then decide to pay it off early, and there's no penalty. We don't go longer than 18 months because then it's like a lot of payments. They have to get the money to the bank. They can have one person collect money from various, get it to the bank, but we don't move the money. We don't have our people moving the money. Then they're set up for potential risk if they get tracked, you know. So, so, you know, 18 payments is a lot of effort. 24 is more effort for them and us. So we keep it at about 18 months.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you've got the smallest systems that we talked about sort of for the most far out rural areas, remote areas. And then I saw on your website, you're doing all sorts of households in Honduras Is that what's the biggest system that you put in there? Are you also doing larger systems, or is it all on the small side?
Well, when it comes to off-grid, typically the largest systems that are common, other than like special projects from like an NGO or something like that, for your basic private customer, is right now exactly about 920 watts to power a 400 liter freezer and, you know, like a store system. And so those are the off-grid systems. So there's two very distinct markets. There's the off-grid market, where there's no electric grid, and then there's the grid tied, or, you know, grid interconnected market, which we moved into. We actually installed the very first grid tied system at the La Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Honduras, so the national university, in their electrical engineering laboratory. This was done in February 2012. So I've had solar in my house here in Massachusetts since one of the early ones, since 2001. And I've been, I was tracking things, and it got to a point, and I said, well, we're going to have to start to introduce it there. There's no subsidy. So we installed a system there, first one. There was no legislation, no framework to do that. We got a letter of no objection from the electric utility to get that done. We did it at the university. So there were, you know, the very professors that are teaching the electrical engineering students. So we got that through, and did that. It's taken a while to get legislation in place, the framework in place. I mean, we just are getting this year the tariff for excess power that's sent into the grid. So everything had to be self-consumption.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get any benefit if you, it's not. And so residential wasn't very good. If you're not in the house consuming, you're generating solar energy and it's just being given an electric utility. But now that's changing. But it's taken quite a while to become first legal to connect. And then now it's at the point where you'll actually get a benefit for any excess. So we are doing, but, you know, there's two distinct markets, you know, off-grid and on-grid. But within the on-grid market, PV, grid tied, there's different market segments. We have substantial utility scale systems there. Probably, I don't know the exact number, but it's at least 500 megawatts. And, you know, the whole country's not that big. The whole capacity in the country's not that big. So it's like 10% of electricity is coming from solar on utility scale. That's one segment. And those are power purchase agreements to the national utility. Okay. Then you've got the large industrial and commercial, very significant families with, industrial facilities and all. And those are often couple megawatts or, significant. So that's that sector. And a lot of that is done within, even families may even own the bank. So, financing is pretty easy for them to get access. So what we have targeted is a segment, I call it more or less the impact segment. Yeah. And we're providing grid-type PV systems for micro and small enterprises and social institutions, NGOs. We've done a number of children's homes, used to be called orphanages. I mean, we're working with social impact. So that's kind of our niche. I mean, we're working so much in rural areas with small systems. We've decided. So most of our systems are, they've been less than 50 kilowatts.
Yep.
We've got a children's home we're doing now is, it's 32 kilowatts, I think it is. Yeah. And that's happening this month. We've got pre-designed packages that are straight grid tied just to reduce your electric bill.
Yeah.
As small as 2 kilowatts using microinverters, up to say 10 kilowatts for pre-designed packages. And then we can design larger systems as needed. But these are like pre-designed, what size do you need? What can you afford? And we can finance those with Kiva, by the way, because we're targeting micro and small enterprises. There's social impact. And then we have another line, which is prepackaged as well. But these are hybrid systems. So if people want to get the benefit of reducing their electric bill, but also if they value reliable power, and that's going to cost more money to put a hybrid system in with batteries. And that's all about the value of, the value you're capturing is really having reliable power, because there are a lot of power outages in Honduras. It's not as bad as some other countries that I've been in. But, so if somebody doesn't want to just kind of squeak through the power outage, we can give them a system that will, we can sell them a system that will provide backup as well with the batteries. So yeah, that's kind of the range that we're working on. So we, you know, that we've positioned in that really this like the impact segment of what is grid tied. We don't get excited about how many megawatts we install. It's more about how much impact we get, how many people now have electricity in the rural areas, and how many small businesses now can also benefit from this technology to reduce their electric bills. So it's not just the big, powerful companies that can get it, you know. So we have some really interesting work that's we keep pushing the envelope. I mean, new stuff comes in. The technology reduces in cost, but, you know, we've gotten into, you know, Kiva for financing. You know, we monitor our systems online. We've got some really nice products for the grid tied. And in the rural areas, we've done something really special that I wanted to mention to you, Ted. We are working towards universal access. You know, around the world, there's a goal, sustainable development goals. There's 17 of them. One of them is 7. It's about energy. And 7.1 is universal access, supposedly by 2030. So can you really do it? Can you really get to everybody? Can you get what, you know, what is universal access? Don't leave anybody in the dark. And we're working on that in one particular department, the Department of Yoro. It's like a province, Yoro. And so we're working there. And that's where we're really working with these small kits. We've also brought in some private donations to provide a modest discount. So it's basically a discount. Call it a discount rather than a subsidy, but it is a subsidy, so it's a discount to really try and reach and encourage the introduction of the technology to the poorest, most remote areas. I mean, we're working with indigenous populations that their, you know, ancestors have been there for thousands of years. They're still using candles and kerosene lamps. We're reaching them in the remote areas, the mountains where they're raising coffee. So we're saying, can you really, I mean, I've been in this for 40 years, can you really get universal access? Can you reach everybody? And these are people that have been left out with the more larger traditional systems that were funded even by the World Bank in like 2010 and all. There were these larger systems. But now with the PAYGO mechanisms and our ability to finance with Kiva and even this, I've raised some private donations to provide that. It's really a results-based financing so that, you know, we deliver and then we, you know, get the funds. We partnered with a nonprofit organization that has received donations and then we send them an invoice. We've done 50 homes. So for $10,000 of some modest donations, $100 a household, $10,000, we can do 100 households.
What a great goal, 100% goal, and seeing what it takes to get there. You know, we're butting up against time, which I knew we would, because we have so much to talk about. Yeah. And we really just talked about your products and your work in Dominican Republic and Honduras. And, you know, you have worked all over the world. I just, you know, countries like Bangladesh, Bolivia, Ethiopia, Haiti, India, Nepal, Nicaragua, Philippines, Senegal, Argentina. It goes on and on. The final question is, you know, I think there's still about a billion people that lack access, right? Mm-hmm. How do we take what you know now, the real skills, the knowledge? It's as if we need to have mentors. You need to be mentoring people to replicate to get to the scale that we need.
Yeah, well, I really do believe in that, in the mentoring. And I over the years, I've had many interns from universities come in and you know, I bring them into either Dominican Republic or Honduras. We've had some really interesting results from that. For example, Dr. Harish Handi, who founded Selco India, he's well known in this space. He visited me in 1991, the same week that the folks from Sandia Lab came in 1991, visited Dominican Republic. He launched in 1995 Selco India. They've electrified, you know, millions of people there in India. And now he has a foundation and he's doing a lot of replication work. So, you know, one of my biggest success stories is like, and he was designing his master's thesis was going to be centralized solar plants with the mirrors and the whole thing. And he came down to the Dominican Republic and became inspired by seeing what we were doing. And so that, and there's numerous people that have come in that way. And I continue to, to believe in that. And the other thing that we've done, what I believe it, I believe there's a big opportunity for small and medium enterprises like what we have in Honduras. That's kind of like replicate that model. So our company, so we're not trying to like dominate the world and, you know, deliver product all over the world. The way we spread our knowledge and make greater impact is through the consulting side. So I also assisted Grameen Bank to do their business plan in 1997 to get their first startup loan from the IFC, $750,000 in 1997. So that was another insertion of, okay, we work with their staff, get the business plan so they can get through the hurdles. And Grameen Bank has done, you know, the launching of Green Shopkey, just did a lot of electrification there. So that's kind of another example. So for me, it's kind of find some interesting projects where I think I can really have an impact. There's a lot of stuff out there that projects in government activities that don't go anywhere. So it's like, can I go and do something that's going to have an impact? Because I'll be 70 years old next month. I've been in this for 40 years. Time is, you know, you can see the timeline. I want to make sure that my years, I'm still excited to do this, but that my years that I can work on, interesting projects that are, they're going to make an impact. So, yeah, I mean, it's like spread the love. The consulting work is like spread the love. I mean, it's just amazing where this technology has gone. I mean, the scale and the price coming down. I mean, just the other day I bought, delivered in our warehouse, 21 cents a watt for, 585 watt modules, 21 cents a watt, JNCO modules, high quality modules delivered to my warehouse in San Pedro Sula, 21 cents a watt. What did I pay back in 1984?
Yeah, what, $10 a watt or something, right?
It was like $8 to $10 a watt and $84. So calculate that out now, it's like $25-$30 a watt. So, but it was cost effective compared to what people were doing with dry cells and kerosene. I know we're running short, Ted, but it's a fabulous space, this PV space, what's going on. I've stayed the early days, like of the Solar Energy Industry Association and DOE, they were figuring out markets. They had to go all international and all, but a lot of it really kind of pulled into the US, and it's been great to see how it's been, really expanding in the US. But the climate problem is global. So if we could do everything perfectly in the U.S., unless we really spread the love and get the technology around to everybody on the planet, I mean, it's only one piece of the solution, but PV has tremendous potential. I just see it continuing. And I've seen a lot in 40 years, going from when it was just 20.8 megawatts of global production in the world at that point. That's from a document of the DOE. You know, they were really studying this. So it's a fabulous space.
Well, thank you.
Have this opportunity to mention that.
Yeah, great stuff. Great discussion. Thanks so much for this discussion, and more so for the model that you've developed. This is so exciting. So, Richard, thank you. Have a great day.
You're welcome, and it's been a pleasure to be able to be invited into your podcast. So, take care.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's EcoLogic. We'll see you next time.